98.1. This is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Welcome back to The Lines Between Us, our weekly series about inequality in the Baltimore region. Next Friday is the 59th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka, which ordered the racial integration of American public schools. The case was argued before the U.S. Supreme Court by Baltimore's own Thurgood Marshall. It remains probably the most famous instance of inequality being challenged successfully in court. What role do courts play today for those who want to challenge inequality in the Baltimore region? With us are two attorneys with long, distinguished careers in civil rights litigation. Ted Shaw is a professor at Columbia Law School in New York, and he was with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund for 23 years, including four as president. Ted Shaw, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And Susan Gehring has been the executive director of the Maryland branch of the American Civil Liberties Union since 1996. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Sheila.
Now, Susan, the Maryland ACLU worked on a case called Thompson v. U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Thompson v. HUD, which we've covered extensively in this series. It was about former residents of overwhelmingly poor and black public housing high-rises in Baltimore ending up in neighborhoods just as segregated as the towers were when they were brought down. A federal judge ruled in 2005 that HUD needed to take a regional approach to the city's public housing. And now there's a program to help city residents with housing vouchers to move to higher opportunity communities across the region. Tell me about your strategy, how you looked for a way to get courts to address residential segregation.
Sure. So let's begin with the historical sort of context of this. So there were Negro public housing units and white public housing buildings, really. And so there was serious segregation, and that didn't really change. There was momentum through all the years. So sometimes we'll be talking during this time we're together about structural racism. And I think housing is one of the best examples of it because there are literally brick and mortar monuments to Jim Crow. And those four large towers that you talked about being taken down were an opportunity for the ACLU to ask the government what's going to happen in its place.
You filed this case based on what? Based on
the
Constitution?
Things. Yes.
Based on what was your legal underpinning?
We filed the case based on two things. One is the Constitution, the 14th Amendment, Equal Protection Clause. And the second was we filed under the Fair Housing Act, which is a statutory basis for the lawsuit. So it's definitely based on race.
And what was the significance of using the Federal Housing Act?
Well, the Federal Housing Act actually allowed us not to have to prove intent in the same way that you're required to prove intent when you go to court in civil rights cases under the Constitution. So that was a big help. And in the end, it turned out that we actually won on the Fair Housing Act.
And so, why is the standard different in the Fair Housing Act?
Well, the standard is different. The standard is different because the Supreme Court has ruled that intent is required before you can win any kind of a civil rights, constitutional civil rights case. So under the Fair Housing Act, there's an obligation to affirmatively further fair housing on the part of defendants, and in this case, the government. And so that meant that if the statistics were bad, which they clearly were, we already had an advantage over trying to prove intent, because intent's very hard to prove, especially when a lot of the actors from the 1930s were gone. They were dead.
Susan described to us using the Fair Housing Act as well as the Constitution. Are there other laws, Ted Shaw, that a litigator can use to get the court to do something that perhaps the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution would be too hard to use?
Well, let me just say that not only was I at the Legal Defense Fund when the Legal Defense Fund joined the case, but Susan and I had worked as co-counsel in a case in Kansas City, Missouri that involved primarily school desegregation, but we put on huge amounts of housing evidence. Are there other laws that can be used? There are state laws that are available. There are laws that have to do with the making and formation of contracts that maybe can be brought to bear on individual cases. But by far, the most potent of the civil rights statutes and laws with respect to housing is the Fair Housing Act. And I should also say, although I may be jumping the gun, that the folks who are on the other side of civil rights litigation have been putting the Fair Housing Act's effects test in their crosshairs. and we have escaped. We've dodged the bullets temporarily with respect to challenges to that standard, the effects test. But the law has been interpreted consistently since its enactment to be enforced with an effects test. By the way, let me just say that I'm a little under the weather, as you know, and so I can't vouch for what my voice is going to do.
Susan, let me spare Ted Shaw's voice and ask you to summarize for us the importance of that case in Kansas City, the Missouri v. Jenkins.
So that case was, I think it's fair to say, the last of the Brown v. Board of Education genre of cases.
And tell me what you mean by
well,
that.
Well, by Brown v. Board of Education, I mean the kind of evidence that was put on. There was evidence of some intent put in, and there were, remember, this was a compilation of a number of cases, so it was, mm-hmm. may have been different in each case. But at the trial court level, there was evidence of intent by the actors, the government actors. And that becomes very difficult when you're three decades past Brown.
And as I understand it, the schools in Kansas City were overwhelmingly black. The federal judge ordered Kansas City to spend a lot of money to try to correct the situation, correct, Ted? And the judge would not consider reaching beyond the boundaries of the city.
All that's correct. As they say, it's complicated. The moment that the Kansas City School District became majority black, that's the last time, almost the last moment, in which it enacted a tax levy or a bond issue. And so you had a school district that not only was segregated, but became unable to fund itself. The significance of this case is that it was an example of how segregation impacted housing, how housing then impacted the school segregation, and then the school district became a racially impacted school district, and it affected the well-being of the entire metropolitan area. But the judge ultimately gave limited relief, that relief, because he had let out the suburban school districts and couldn't desegregate the students, that relief ended up being largely financial, magnet schools, et cetera. It was very controversial because it ultimately ended up being about $1 billion. By the time the Supreme Court got a hold of it a couple of times, the court had changed, become more conservative, was getting out of the business of school desegregation, and essentially said that the remedy was much too extreme, wasn't justified. This was one of a series of cases that signaled the Supreme Court's exit from the Brown versus Board of Education effort. You know, for those of us who entered the practice of law inspired by what happened in Brown versus Board of Education and subsequent cases, that Brown paradigm, the notion that we could bring about social change through law. You know, one of the lessons that we've learned, or at least it's a lesson that I've learned, is that paradigm is a powerfully seductive paradigm, but it's one that we need to understand. We need to understand its limitations. We need to understand what it can do and what it can't do.
That's Ted Shaw, former NAACP Legal Defense Fund president, here on WIPR, The Lines Between Us on Maryland Morning. Also here with me is Susan Gehring, director of the ACLU of Maryland. And we're talking about challenging inequality in the courts. Susan, two of the big high-profile discrimination cases that the ACLU here in Maryland is known for are sometimes called the Driving While Black cases. A consent decree with the Maryland State Police over racial profiling that was in the 90s, I think.
That's right.
And a settlement with Baltimore City Police in a case alleging a pattern of improper arrests in the 2000s. How do those cases fit in with what we've been talking about here, what courts can and cannot accomplish?
Right. Well, they're both cases that are brought against the government, against the police in particular, in one case the Baltimore City and the other case the Maryland State Police. They both have been cases that we've settled and are now monitoring, as we must do for these large cases, to make sure that the policy matches the constitutional guarantee or the statutory guarantee.
Ted Shaw, I don't want to overinterpret what you said, but it sounds to me as if you're sort of saying the courtroom is no longer the place where real gains can be made.
Well, let me try to be very clear on this. I think that it's vitally important that there be lawyers who are committed to protecting and enforcing civil rights, and they need to be in the courtroom. That will continue to be so. But the point I'm making is that when we talk about real change, you know, societal change, we have to have activists. We have to have people on the ground. You know, my own belief is that when lawyers think they're going to lead social movements in their role as lawyers, those movements are doomed to failure. You know, Gandhi was a lawyer. He didn't lead the movement for Indian independence and against colonialism in his role as a lawyer. Mandela's a lawyer. Didn't lead the fight against apartheid in his role as a lawyer, even though in both those instances it was vitally important that lawyers work with people who were activists. And that's true here in this society also.
I'd like to add something else to the equation here, the thesis of former ACLU lawyer Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Michelle Alexander says that civil rights advocates and litigators have focused on issues like affirmative action at the expense of something she sees as much more important, high levels of incarceration of African Americans, especially young African American males. Ted, do you agree with that?
Well, with all due respect to Michelle, whom I know and admire, and in fact, in full disclosure, I'm on the board of the New Press, which published The New Jim Crow. I take some issue, and it's not just being defensive. I don't think it's ever been either or. There have been, at the same time, the defense of affirmative action efforts and trying to keep the doors of opportunity to higher education and selective institutions open at the same time as we were, in fact, bringing cases that had to do with this mass incarceration. So, for example, at the Legal Defense Fund and at the ACLU, for that matter, we were both involved in a case in the 90s and early 2000s of, in Tulia, Texas, in which 10% of the Black population of this tiny town in the panhandle of Texas were arrested in a pre-dawn raid, allegedly for drug violations. No money, no weapons, no drugs found, all on the word of one corrupt and later proven to be racist police officer. Well, you know, we saw that issue. We got on that issue, and we saw it as an issue that that was an example of this mass over-incarceration. And so, we've been engaged in both issues. It can't be either or.
But she seems to be saying, Susan, it almost gets back in my mind to what you were talking about, the court requiring a standard that something that discrimination be intentional. If I understand Michelle Alexander's argument, it is almost that there is that the criminal justice system, the criminal side of the courts in which these same civil rights gains that we've been talking about have been made, the criminal justice system is intentionally controlling and keeping African Americans from exercising civil rights, from being full citizens in this country.
Well, I would love to hear from Ted on this, but my feeling is that it's difficult to use the courts, especially difficult to use the courts in the case of the criminal justice system. And part of that has to do with the various points at which people come into contact before they even get into the prison. There are so many points at which you could have to prove intent that it becomes, I think, very difficult. At the point when somebody is stopped on the street, at the point when they're arrested, at the point when they're in detention, do they get a bail, good bail hearing? Do they have attorneys at the bail hearing? And then, you know, on and on, and then the trial. And so, and then where they get placed, and then how many of them the sort of
how they're dealt with within the system then also is a function of the particular people who are in charge of their lives. And so I just think it's really important, and I would love to hear from Ted on that.
Ted.
Well, it's absolutely true. You see, the criminal justice system, the way it works by and large is that individuals are prosecuted as individuals. When we talk about the kinds of cases that Susan worked on and that the Legal Defense Fund worked on with the ACLU in Baltimore, the housing case, you know, Thompson, we're talking about systemic issues, large issues involving much more than individuals, although individuals certainly are ultimately the beneficiaries of what we're trying to accomplish. The criminal justice system doesn't work in that same way. And so the courts have erected all kinds of barriers to bringing litigation that changes the way the criminal justice system interacts with individuals, particularly on the basis of race that I could talk about. And it is a very, in my view, a very cynical jurisprudence. It is a misplaced jurisprudence, but that's the jurisprudence that we have. And so it's not easy to attack inequality in the criminal justice system. There are some cases pending, for example, in New York right now, where I live, having to do with stop-and-frisk policies in which, upwards of 500,000 African-American, largely, and Latino youth are being stopped and frisked every year. There's another case pending having to do with vertical sweeps in housing projects in largely black and Latino neighborhoods. So these cases are being brought, but it's difficult for the most part to win these cases in courts that are very hostile. Susan is actually is absolutely right about the points at which the criminal justice system touches upon individuals.
So one of the things we're doing here in Maryland, Sheila, is trying to use the legislative process and also trying to change hearts and minds on parallel track with the legislative process when it comes to over-incarceration. And there are laws that can be passed. So, for instance, 2 years ago in the session, we actually allied ourselves with a Republican from Western Maryland who came to us and said, you know, I've been looking at the parole and probation system. It makes no sense. There are no graduated sanctions. Somebody can be, who's on parole or probation, can forget to go to see his officer and then get thrown into jail for that, or commit a murder and get thrown, back into prison for that. And so we got together, and there was it was only a pilot, but there is a pilot bill that got passed to look at a graduated sanctions and see if that works. The other thing that's happening is a lot of the over-incarceration, white and black, resulted from the war on drugs. So one thing that we're looking at as a possibility is small amounts of marijuana. And as you may know, in the Senate this last session, there was, out of nowhere, the Senate passed a bill that would have, for a small amount of marijuana, had the police issue citations rather than cart somebody off.
Like a traffic ticket.
Exactly.
Didn't pass the House.
It didn't pass the House, but we're hopeful that it may. In 2010, Maryland had the seventh highest number of arrests in the country for marijuana.
Seventh highest per capita or in sheer numbers?
Yeah, per capita. And half of those, 50% of all the drug arrests in Maryland, were marijuana arrests. A lot of those people are possessions, right?
Possession of small amounts.
Exactly. And so that would make a pretty dramatic difference in the arrests. The arrests get people, a lot of those people, again, because of maybe racial bias in the system, once they're arrested, that is almost a guarantee that they will have some continuation with the criminal justice system. 80% of the people incarcerated in Maryland are African American. And if you do a breakdown for any drug, it is always the case that even though blacks and whites use drugs at the same proportion, African-Americans always, by three times, is the figure overrepresented in the criminal justice system for drug use.
Ted Shaw and Susan Gehring, thank you.
Thank you.
Susan Gehring is director of ACLU Maryland. Ted Shaw is a Columbia Law School professor and former president of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. Go to linesbetweenus.org to hear how ACLU Maryland used the state constitution, not federal guarantees, to challenge inequality in the classroom and what it took to convert the judge's decision in the courtroom into funding in the classroom. Also at linesbetweenus.org, more information about some of the cases we discussed. That's it for the Lines Between Us today. After a break, Maryland Morning returns with the directors of a documentary about the legacy of the Catonsville Nine. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us on 88.1.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Lines Between Us, WYPR's year-long exploration of inequality in the Baltimore region. This is Maryland Morning senior producer Lawrence Lanahan. Now, join the conversation at facebook.com/thelinesbetweenus or tell us your story at linesbetweenus.org. The Lines Between Us is made possible by grants from Associated Black Charities, Cohen Opportunity Fund, Ethics and Excellence in Journalism Foundation, Baltimore Community Foundation, and Open Society Institute Baltimore, as well as support from members of the WYPR Board of Directors. I hope you'll join us again on Friday at 9 a.m. on 88.1 FM in the Baltimore region, and everywhere else, streaming live at wypr.org. Have a great day.